Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett Florida. Hello, everybody. This is Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson welcoming you to our first podcast of 2020. It's going to be a heck of a year in Florida politics, so don't forget to listen to this podcast every week. We have a lot to discuss. I'm joined, as always, this week from Tallahassee by Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy. Happy New Year, John.
Hey, Zach, and a belated Happy New Year to you, too.
And making a special guest appearance is Daytona Beach News Journal political editor Mark Harper. Hey, Mark, thanks for joining the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Zach and John. Good to be here.
Great to have you. We're going to talk to Mark about a really fascinating story he wrote about the absolutely massive amounts of money controlled by Florida lawmakers in their political action committees and what that means for politics and policy in this great state of ours. We'll also look ahead to the 2020 legislative session, which kicks off next week. And we'll touch on one of the holdovers from 2019 that is still on Congress's to-do list. And no, it's not the impeachment trial. It's the NAFTA rewrite and how it's playing in Florida. But first, that funky music means it's time for our pick a number segment. Guests go first. Mark Harper, what number are you laying down to kick off 2020?
I'm going to go with $14.6
billion. All right. A big, bold number to start the new year. John Kennedy, I know you have another bold number to kick off 2020. What are you throwing out here?
Zach, I do. I can't top our guest, though. My first number for the new year, for the new decade even, is 1,027.
1,027. Well, that would have been pretty robust if Mark hadn't come in so strong with that first number. And I'm gonna keep it keep going down the chain here with a 47. So that's Zach Anderson with a 47. John Kennedy 1,027. And Mark Harper with 14.6 billion. Write those numbers down, folks. Remember them. We'll come back at the end of the show and tell you what they mean for Florida politics. Well, it's an election year in Florida and a big one at that. President Donald Trump needs to win the state to win re-election, and the Democrats are eager to deny him that victory. That means a boatload of money is going to be flowing into the state for political advertisements, many of them paid for by shadowy political action committees. But it's not just the big time presidential campaigns that have those PACs. These days, even your lowly state House and Senate members can pile up massive sums of money in these committees, and there's no limit to how much an individual or corporation can contribute to one of these PACs. Mark wrote about this in a recent story that ran in Gannett newspapers across Florida. Mark, your story had some really eye-catching numbers. PACs controlled by current state House and Senate members have raised nearly $750 million. That's three-quarters of $1 billion for PACs that are controlled by what are really part-time legislators. I mean, they're only up there for a part of the year. Money poured into these PACs from special interests around the state, including the tobacco industry, marijuana companies, sugar farmers, electric utilities, and insurance companies, just to name a few. The majority of that PAC money was raised by Republican lawmakers who have majorities in both the House and the Senate. Mark, what are some of the most interesting things you uncovered during your reporting on these political money machines?
Yeah, at one point I wanted to write something really circular, like money begats power begats money begats power begats, then I decided I didn't really know whether it would be begats or begets. I moved on to something else, but
I like the begets.
The central idea, the relationship between money and power, is what underlies all of this. And I think the one of the set of facts that underscores this, I think, is, the last Democratic governor was Buddy McKay in 1999, and the last Democratic-controlled House was 96, and the last Democratic-controlled Senate was 92, and yet the number of registered Democrats in Florida as of September 30th was more than 200,000 more registered voters than Republicans. And considering maybe why that might be, one of the reasons is the amount raised by Democrat lawmaker controlled PACs as of late in 2019 was 19 million, and the amount raised by Republican lawmakers was like 728 million. So the lawmakers who are allowed to chair their own PACs have been attracting more and more money from industries such as power companies and agriculture and big sugar. You know, people who frequently have business before the legislature, and they're dropping just, jaw-dropping sums of money, $10,000, $25,000, sometimes even $50,000 a pop. The lawmakers who are good at this game are able to rake in like millions of dollars. The House Speaker, Jose Oliva, has a PAC that has collected more than $4 million in his career, and he has more than $1 million of it at his disposal today, which he can use to help fellow Republicans get elected and keep the Republicans in the majority.
And you raise a really interesting point, Mark. There a lot of people might not realize this because Florida has been controlled at the state level by Republicans for so long, Republican governor for more than two decades, Republican majorities in the state House and the Senate. But there's actually more registered Democrats in this state than Republicans. And we see that in the fact that it is a really a swing state at the presidential level. But one way that Republicans have stayed in power is that, you know, as you say, power begets money, and they've raised a ton of money while they're in power from special interests who are trying to influence them. And that has helped them be able to fend off Democrats who might have a voter registration advantage, right?
Yeah, yeah. It just is a reality in Florida, you know, that lawmakers are allowed to have their own political committees, and they're able to raise unlimited amounts for those committees. Yeah. And so that spiraled upward.
And one of the PACs highlighted in your story, Mark, is Conservatives for Principled Leadership, which is controlled by Republican State House member Paul Renner. Renner is in line to be Speaker of the House, so he's got a lot of clout and people are eager to influence him. And, you know, it's interesting how that influence happens. It's a pretty rarefied world. You noted that Renner's PAC paid $13,000 for a trip to Oregon wine country. This is a Florida lawmaker traveling to Oregon wine country where guests experienced multiple wine tastings and food from a private chef affiliated with the Oregon Truffle Festival. Sounds like a pretty swank trip. And in return, Renner reported raising $250,000 for his PAC that month. A lot of people would wonder if this kind of literal whining and dining with lobbyists and special interests affects Renner's approach to legislation. Do these donors who go on the trip with him get more favorable treatment? Any thoughts on that, Mark?
Well, you know, Renner says it doesn't steer his votes and that donors he's met are not transactional in that way. In many cases, the donors are giving money to people who have like-minded philosophies. The money is perhaps not specifically tied to a particular bill or vote. And, you know, if it is, that's awful hard to prove. But the money, you know, is there to further their cause in a more general sense. And it's also a way to guarantee access and build relationships. I would say that it usually provides the donors more favorable treatment in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned access and relationships. I mean, for a lot of lobbyists, that's what they covet. You know, I mean, they want to be able to at least get their voice heard, get in the door. And if you've spent, you know, a weekend with a guy drinking wine at wine tasting events and having private meals catered by a private chef and having these intimate conversations, then you call up his office, he's more likely to take your call, right? I mean, maybe
sure.
It is an explicit quid pro quo, but it certainly gets you in the door, right?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And while not all lawmakers have their own political committees or PACs, a lot of them do. And the ones who do have them, you know, Renner's trip kind of stood out because of some of the details, but really these lawmakers are traveling a lot. They're it's not that unusual for a lawmaker with a PAC to, you know, visit different parts of the country, spend money on, you know, spirits and food and, you know, travel expenses, in the name of raising money. So, Renner, I kind of highlighted his trip, but you know, there are plenty of other examples.
It sounds like it's not just a Democratic presidential candidate, Pete Buttigieg, who knows his way around a wine cave. Our own Paul Renner, knows a little bit about, Chardonnays versus, a nice oaky Sauvignon Blanc or something.
Glad that we could get a wine cave reference into our first podcast of the new year. I think we'll be hearing more about that as the Democratic primary for president unfolds here. Well, really, really great reporting, Mark. I thought that it's just a really interesting story. And sometimes we get like sort of accustomed to thinking, well, this is just the way it is. And you have to pull back a little bit and just put this in perspective, because it is an incredible amount of money, $750 million for, people, especially some of these like state house members you're representing, just over 100,000 people, it's amazing the amount of money that people control at all levels of politics now. And, the average person doesn't have $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 to put into one of these PACs that can accept unlimited donations. So you just wonder what people are getting for their money when they put it into these PACs. Well, it's no secret that special interests have a lot of influence on Tallahassee, and that will be on display next week when Florida's annual 60-day legislative session kicks off. Beyond the special interest food fights, there are plenty of other big issues to watch this year. John, you've been tracking the run-up to this session. What should we be watching for as lawmakers get ready to converge on Tallahassee?
Yeah, well, it's an election year season session. And so both Democrats and Republicans are going to be doing some angling on issues that they think may position themselves best for the fall campaigns. Republicans who have big majorities in the House and Senate, they're pushing abortion-related legislation this year, a new parental consent requirement for minor girls. We've talked a lot about that on this podcast earlier. This is one of those issues that helps drive base voters really on both sides. And Governor Ron DeSantis also has thrown into the mix an issue intended to help President Trump fan that immigration issue going forward. The governor wants the legislature to require all Florida businesses to use the federal E-Verify database to determine whether employees are legally eligible to work in this country. But that leads into what may be really the most dominant storyline of this session, and that's how DeSantis fares in year two of his administration. The legislature last year gave him mostly everything he wanted, a very good political honeymoon that helped DeSantis get really strong popularity ratings and boost his national profile. But this year, we're already seeing that the Republican-led legislature is starting to push back against the governor. Senate President Bill Galvano isn't a fan of the E-Verify requirement. That brings him in line with most of Florida's big business groups, which also don't like the added demand if it happens. And House Speaker Jose Oliva has been feuding with DeSantis over the governor's ask to keep Visit Florida alive. That's the tourist marketing agency that's set to disappear on June 30th, because Oliva and other conservatives just don't see a real need for the state to be marketing itself at the $50 million level that Visit Florida gets at least this year. They see that as a waste of money. And, you also have both legislative leaders have some kind of heartburn over DeSantis's most signature issue this year. That's an almost $1 billion teacher pay and bonus plan. Galvano wants to recast how the money is spent, and Oliva is, he's mostly worried about whether the state can afford it, it seems. So the bumpy ride that the second-year governor may face is really one of the themes to watch for this session. And DeSantis, of course, is under a tremendous pressure to keep Florida in the president's corner come the November election. So whether Republicans can keep a unified front this session may be a key to assuring that kind of smooth sailing in the fall.
So everybody's going to be watching to see if the honeymoon is over for Governor DeSantis. Mark, you've covered DeSantis for a while now. He was a congressman from your area. I wonder what you think of where he stands right now after his first year and some of the proposals that he's pitching as he goes into his second year as governor, calling for a big increase in starting teacher pay, E-Verify. I know that's an issue, the immigration issue that he's always talked about. I'm sure you saw that when he was in Congress. Any thoughts on where he stands going into his second session here?
Well, it seems like he's sailing in nicely into his second year, and he has a lot of goodwill built up and seems to have a pretty high approval rating. This session could of course affect that, but he's I think this morning I attended a local chamber of commerce breakfast where they were talking about their legislative priorities, and they were all gung-ho about the work DeSantis is doing, and generally speaking they supported the starting teacher pay increase, although there's certainly a lot of room for debate as to how that money should be used. Should it all be used at the starting level or for teachers who have been more veteran teachers? But generally there's a lot of goodwill about the work DeSantis is doing, and he seems to definitely have support in these necks of the woods here in Volusia County.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, he's been pretty savvy about the issues that he's focused on, and poll after poll continues to show him with pretty high approval ratings here. So we'll see how that changes, or if it changes throughout this legislative session. I mean, the issues that he's focused on, things like teacher pay, are pretty broadly popular, right, John? I mean, he kind of has the high ground on this. Oliva, might be able to say that, I have to try and, make sure that we're being fiscally responsible here. But DeSantis sort of has a popular opinion on his side, doesn't he?
He does. But remarkably, he has even the teachers union against him on this issue, the Florida Education Association. And they're making a very high profile push for a much broader kind of pay package that could be made available to all education system employees. And they're trying to create support for something that they're calling kind of like the decade of education in Florida. So really trying to increase funding for schools and also giving local counties more authority over how they distribute pay money. There may be a union component in that those are the bargaining units that, negotiate with every school district around the state. But they have a different take on what DeSantis has proposed. But yeah, it does seem hard to argue with a Republican governor that's putting almost $1 billion on the table for teachers. That's a pretty out of the box move by a Republican leader in this state.
Yeah, I mean, the union might argue that this money comes with certain strings attached, but in the end, I'm sure they'll be happy to take it if DeSantis can push it through the legislature. Well, pulling back from Tallahassee for a minute, there's a lot going on in Congress as we head into the new year. Us politicos are already thinking ahead to the election, but there's still plenty of action that will occur in the U.S. Capitol building, including an impeachment trial. The Senate also is expected to take up President Donald Trump's rewrite of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. The renegotiated agreement is now known as U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. It passed the House last month with bipartisan support. 193 Democrats voted for the trade deal, and 192 Republicans voted for it, which is pretty remarkable bipartisan unity on major legislation. And it shows the pendulum really has swung away from free trade in both parties. And there's a lot of concern about protecting American jobs. And we saw some of the same bipartisan support for USMCA here in Florida. All but one member of the state's congressional delegation voted for the trade deal. 13 Democrats supported it and 13 Republicans. And what was really interesting to me is that they basically ignored staunch opposition to this deal from Florida farmers who compete directly with Mexican farmers to supply fresh fruits and vegetables during the winter months. Florida farmers complain that cheap imports from Mexico are driving them out of business and that they can't compete with the low labor costs across the border. John, the farm industry in Florida traditionally has been pretty influential. Does it surprise you that Florida lawmakers backed this deal despite opposition from farmers? It seems like Republicans were especially wary of crossing Trump on this.
This did seem to be an issue where Florida Republicans went against their own state's interests in many respects, but the need for a Trump victory on this trade deal really seemed to overwhelm concerns about Florida farmers. Florida, after all, is in a unique spot as a winter vegetable growing competitor with Mexico, which now is positioned to cut into the state. We talked a moment ago about this E-Verify controversy, too. Well, that's another issue where farmers oppose that in Florida, saying that this is a federal responsibility that shouldn't be put on private businesses. And of course, agriculture, we know, is well known for hiring a sizable number of undocumented laborers. So, of course, another thing to remember is DeSantis and his mentor, President Trump, that they have never been that supportive of some of the traditional protections granted agriculture by the federal government. DeSantis was a critic in Congress of sugar price supports, which, really defied a major industry in this state. And Trump also has a pretty freewheeling trade policy. So Florida farmers, while very politically influential historically in the state and nationwide, they seem to be sort of the sacrifice in this larger three-nation deal.
Yeah, I think Republicans were worried about upsetting farmers. There's a lot of support for Republican candidates from rural parts of the state. And they were talking about how they want to protect farmers and maybe they can get some separate legislation that would protect Florida farmers. But that seems unlikely to go anywhere. And the bottom line is that this just shows that how influential Trump is. I mean, Republicans are scared to death to cross him, even when it means going against the interests of individuals in their own state. Well, let's move on to some number picking. We'll go from highest to lowest. Mark, you came in today with $14.6 billion. What's that all about?
That's the amount of money that Florida Tax Watch estimates the state lost in federal funding as a result of the state's undercount in the 2010 census. Considering the annual population growth Florida gets, any undercount in Florida is bound to be multiplied because of, more and more people moving to the state, throughout the decade, which all of this is a way to just underscore why Floridians might want to be counted accurately in this year's census.
And that's a timely number because DeSantis just formed a census committee to try and ensure that Floridians are every Floridian is counted, right?
Well, he did. It's much later than Charlie Crist formed his committee in 2010. Really is only coming about 2 months before, people are going to start filling out their forms. So I don't know, how much ground this committee can cover in 2 months, but he did finally come around to forming a census complete count committee.
A lot of money at stake, and potentially a couple of congressional seats that Florida could gain. So definitely an important issue to watch. John, your number was 1,027. Tell us about that.
Zach, that is the number of lobbyists who have registered to work the Florida legislature this year. That's sort of in keeping with our theme here of special interest money. That works out to be about 6.5 lobbyists for every one of the 160 Florida legislators. Not sure how that half a lobbyist is going to work out, but that's a lot of lobbyists prowling the halls of the Capitol either way.
6-1. You can have them completely surrounded.
And there's probably more to be added to this list since session is just beginning. In past years, the ratio of lobbyists to legislators has been more like 12-1. basically double what we have registered this week. Now, this same crowd of lobbyists, they report that they're representing just under 2,500 principals. Now, that's companies, associations, governments, and other entities. We've been talking with Mark about the kind of money that flows from these political spending committees to legislators. Well, a lot of these lobbyists and companies are the people who are behind that cash. Now, not every one of these lobbyists, of course, is a fat cat. There are plenty of lobbyists who register with the state who represent a lone client, and sometimes these clients are low budget but are seeking to get some funding in the state budget or have a single issue they're watching. But there are plenty of multi-million dollar lobbying firms honing in on these legislators. And in the first 3 months of last year, for example, that included the opening month of the legislative session, just under $40 million was spent by companies, government, and other entities to hire lobbyists. So, Tallahassee doesn't have much industry, but lobbying continues to boom in this town.
John, now every time I think about Tallahassee, I'm going to think about one lawmaker walking through the halls of the Capitol surrounded by six lobbyists.
Six and a half.
Yeah, six and a half. Fascinating. Well, that it's always good to start off the year pointing out the influence machine that greases the wheels in Tallahassee. It is a huge issue that, as I mentioned earlier, talking about Mark's PAC story, that sometimes we just forget how much money and effort there is put into trying to influence some of this legislation. And, lawmakers try and say that that they're just pushing things that they believe in. But I think anybody who has watched Tallahassee long enough knows that there is a lot of special interest influence that determines what legislation advances and what does not. Well, my number is 47, and that's the percentage of Florida voters that support Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden in a Mason-Dixon poll that was released just before the new year. Biden leads President Donald Trump in Florida by just 2 percentage points in the poll, which is within the margin of error. So basically a toss-up right now. What's also noteworthy is that Biden is the only Democratic candidate who leads Trump in Florida in that poll. Trump is beating the three other top Democratic contenders, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg, in head-to-head matchups. So that's a good measuring stick to keep in mind as we head into 2020. Right now, it looks like Trump stacks up pretty well in Florida against most of the Democratic field. Lastly, it's the new year, so we thought we'd offer up a few predictions for the folks listening out there, things that you can come back to at the end of the year to see if our political intuition is that savvy. John Kennedy, have you looked into your crystal ball to tell us what we can expect out of Florida politics in 2020?
Well, I've been looking at my magic eight ball. And I'll predict that while these January legislative session starts are designed to get the 2 month session out of the way and allow legislators to start campaigning, I think they'll actually wind up back in Tallahassee for a special session or two this year. I think one area that could bring the legislature back is if a federal trial scheduled to start in April over the new law allowing felons to get their voting rights back only after paying court fines, fees, and restitution. If that gets thrown out by the federal court, I think there could be a clamor to come back and craft a new law in time for getting at least some of those 1.4 million felons onto the voting rolls. And I think also it's possible that, as strong as the economy looks right now, it's always possible global issues could change quickly. And maybe the state budget that the legislature approves by mid-March has to be retooled, maybe significantly. So I don't know, my prediction, maybe one short special session or maybe even two. Tallahassee in summertime is delightfully hot and steamy.
John, giving politicos around the state heart palpitations about having to,
4th of July in Tallahassee.
Yeah, it could be lovely. How about you, Mark? Do you have a prediction for us?
I'm not sure. Maybe you can help me with what a good number is, but I was thinking maybe something like 180 or so bills maybe passed this year.
Sounds about right.
I think I'm going to go with the under.
So. Yeah, you know, I'll take the under too. I think in an election year session, less is more, and they're not going to want to get too deep into the weeds on a lot of this stuff. But a lot of bills filed, very few make it across the finish line. Well, I predict that Florida plays an important role in the Democratic presidential nomination, and that the winner of the Florida primary goes on to win the nomination. Florida's March 17th primary is late in the process. It comes after the four early states and also after a bunch of other states vote on Super Tuesday and then a second Super Tuesday. But I think that with so many viable candidates in the race, that it will still be competitive when it gets to Florida, and that Democrats here will help decide the contest. Bloomberg isn't even playing in the early states. He's already advertising in Florida, so he looks like he's going to be sticking around to challenge whoever makes it through some of these early states. So I think early on, it looked like maybe our primary was not going to be that meaningful, that the nomination might be wrapped up by the time it gets to Florida. But I don't think that's going to be the case right now. So we'll have to wait and see. It's coming up pretty soon, though. That wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team, Thomas Cordy and Joseph Pisano. Thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.